Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Madi Sato about her new disc, Return to the River, and we'll be talking about the Santa Fe Tap Dance Festival. I'd like now to welcome to the program Kevin McDonald. He's the director of the film Life in a Day, which screens at the CCA here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. It's great to have you on. This is an extraordinary film. I've now seen it twice. I will probably see it again. I've never seen anything like
it.
Wow,
that's great. I don't know anyone else who's seen it three times.
Well, I've got to three, but well, I mean, here's the concept of the film. You put out a call to people to film their all over the world. To film their lives on July 24th, 2010, and then collected this footage. It was 4,500 hours worth of footage. How did you make this call in the first place? How did you get the word out to people?
Well, that's the wonder of the internet, in part. We had YouTube as our partners on this, and they loved the concept of the film, and they helped us put it together, and they helped pay for it. So we set up a channel on YouTube, and they helped us on their homepage. They helped us advertise the film, and then also I just did a lot of interviews like this. I did a lot of the traditional media kind of getting the word out there. I did 23 American breakfast TV shows in one day, for instance. Then by satellite from London, and I talked for another day. I talked to journalists in Latin America, and so on, so on. I spent about 2 weeks just doing press, and that's how we got the word out. And amazing thing is that we got footage back from 192 countries, and I believe that the commonly accepted total number of countries in the world is 196. So we're pretty only four shy of every country in the world.
Amazing. So when this footage came back, 4,500 hours means if you watch for 12 hours a day every day for a year, then you get to see it all. Obviously, no one person can do that. How did you divide out the work of looking at all this footage?
Well, we had a deadline as well, because we wanted to get the film into Sundance this year. And so, obviously, it's only 6 months, really, from July 24th to the end of January, which is when Sundance is. So, as you say, no one person could watch all this material, and they'd probably go crazy if they tried. So what we did was we hired 24 young assistants who were kind of assistant editors or researchers who spoke many different languages. Of course, there was material here from many different parts of India and different dialects of different Indian languages. There were things from Japan, China, all over. So we had people who spoke many of the most common languages, and they were educated by myself and the editor, Joe Walker, into what to look out for, what we thought was interesting, what we didn't think was interesting, and set to work. And they watched 12 hours a day for 2 months, really, between them. And they got through everything, and they gave it a star rating from 1 to 5, so 1 being, the person who made this has put less effort into making it than we have actually in just viewing it, into 5, which is, this is really fantastic, and I think this should be in the movie. And then there was a 6-star for So Bad It's Good, which was embarrassing teenagers mostly in their bedrooms dancing to themselves, and that kind of thing. So that's how we went through it. And then I personally only watched about 350 hours, which was the best stuff, the 4- and 5-star material. And even then watching that, it was very obvious, day one you're watching it and you're thinking, oh, everything's fantastic. I'm inside somebody's bedroom in Pakistan, and I'm at a gas station in Iraq. I'm in I'm at a school in Bolivia. This is amazing. I'm inside people's lives and inside their homes. And by day two, you're like, oh, my God, not another house in Bolivia. So I'm bored of houses in Bolivia.
And you
quickly start to build up this kind of resistance just to the voyeuristic aspect of it, which is obviously fascinating. But you build up resistance to that, and you start to just sit up and pay attention when some things are really fascinating. When there's a great character who grabs you, and you think that's a character I want to spend time with, or when there's a particularly beautiful shot, or an idea that comes across that seems original, and so we really, probably out of all of it, there was probably only 10 hours or so that I thought was really fascinating, that was really interesting. But that's, of course, what I thought was interesting out of it. I mean, I think one of the fascinating things about this project is that you could have 100 directors all be given the same footage, and they all come up with 100 completely different movies.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, editing all of that, even if you've got 10 hours of stellar stuff, you still have to make basically a 90-minute or so movie.
Yeah.
And did you have any kind of concept of how you were going to structure the thing before the footage came in, or did the footage speak to you and tell you how to structure it?
I think the footage spoke to us, and that's very much how I looked at it right from the beginning. I said I didn't want all the sort of editors and things which kept saying to me, what's the film about? And I said, I don't know. How do we know until we've seen the material? And so that was, as a director, I've made like more conventional documentaries, more conventional drama films, and of course it's a complete antithesis to what we directors normally do, which is to try and, bully everybody around us into doing what we want. And in this case, it's the opposite. I had to just sit and say, what is the film saying? What is the world saying on the 24th of July, 2010? And themes just started to emerge, and characters started to emerge. And I always believe in any film that luck plays a huge role, and that when there's so many factors involved in making a film, how can you as the individual control everything? You can't really. Maybe if you're Hitchcock, you can. And so you're always reliant on sort of making luck. And in this film, it's just even more. It's all about serendipity. It's all about what the gods want you to have, what the gods are saying on the 24th of July, 2010.
There, you start before dawn, and there are shots of people doing things and saying things as they are asleep and then get up in the morning and have their coffee, and there's just like a snippet of a lot of different people going through their days. And so I was afraid when I started watching this that it was going to be a kind of crazy, incoherent thing and, it's a small world after all, but who cares? But there was this sense, even though there wasn't really a narrative, there was this sense of a narrative because you used the times of day, at least partially, to structure the film.
Yeah, I mean, the big, my role as a director really was to not just choose, this is interesting to me and this is not interesting to me. My role really was to sort of find a way to make it into a movie. Because I wasn't interested in just presenting a kind of curated series of clips. That is kind of dull. And I think one of the problems we've had with this film and presenting it to the public is that that's what the public think it is. But it's not. It's a movie. And it has a beginning, middle, and end. And it has thematic movements and almost, I guess, almost like a piece of music in that way. Maybe it's simpler to understand it like a piece of classical music in the way that it's structured, and that was how I was able to get the material down from so many hundreds of hours I watched down to 90 odd minutes that's in the film, because not everything kind of fitted into the structure that became obvious, and the structure really was passage through the day. But then it was taking in various themes which were particularly resonant in the footage that I saw. So there was a section in the middle which is structured around some Angolan women who are beating maize and making it into flour and singing these beautiful songs in Angolan language. And it was a very striking clip. I thought that can be used as a structure for a sequence which is about food and consumption of food and production of food and livestock and all those things. So that's then what we did there. We took all these great and fascinating things that people had said and did about connected to food and put that there. So that was sort of lunchtime. And then, of course, what happens after lunch? People go out. They go out and they do activities. So then we go into a sequence which is about, I guess, sports and people kind of enjoying themselves in the world, the sense of exhilaration. So there's people diving and skydiving and on BMX bikes and all of that kind of stuff. But all the way through it, the aim was to try and make something that felt like it's going somewhere. So you feel like you are on a journey. There is some sort of narrative, even if it feels like there is, even if there isn't. And one of the tricks we used to achieve that really was to have recurring characters. So there are certain characters who come back, two, three, four times in the film. But of course, when you first meet them, you don't know who's going to come back.
Right.
You don't know that anyone's going to come back. But it creates a sort of tension because you're thinking, I was interested in that person. I liked that minute or so I spent with them, or that 30 seconds. I got an idea of them. I empathize with them. Are they going to come back? Am I going to learn more about them? And some you do and some you don't. But I think the sort of tension that's created by that actually is one of the factors that keeps you moving through the film.
Well, one falls in love with these people. I mean, the Peruvian, the little Peruvian shoeshine boy and the Korean bicyclist. He's amazing.
That footage was actually something that came because obviously a lot of the footage is the result of just putting out a request and saying, send us what you can, send us, you know, take your cell phone, take your home video camera and film something, then upload it onto YouTube and we'll see if we like it. But some of it was also a result of us sending cameras out, because obviously we wanted the film to be representative of the world, not just of the developed world, and not just of, you know, people who are on YouTube or people who are in North America. So we sent out 450 cameras to the developing world, you know, Southeast Asia and Latin America and Africa, and with a spare memory card. So people got various charities, various aid organizations gave those out in remote parts of these countries, and then the cards were delivered back a week later to the aid organization and then FedEx to us. So, and the person who'd done the filming got to keep the camera. And so that's where that Peruvian footage came from. It's from a very small town just north of Lima somewhere on the coast of Peru, and it's a boy who has no mother and is looked after by his father, and he earns some money by being a shoeshine boy. And he's a fantastic, strong, resilient character who surprises you at the end by showing you his laptop and says that the thing he loves the most in the world is Wikipedia, because you can find everything on Wikipedia. And it's just kind of really unlikely that this shoeshine boy has this laptop that obviously some aid organization has given to him. But there's about 20% of the film comes from those cameras that we sent out. So, you know, film produced, I guess, in a more conventional, old-fashioned way without the use of the internet.
There's also this Korean bicyclist who you show a lot. Tell us a little bit about him.
Yeah, his name is Ok Hwan, and he's been cycling around the world for nine years when he shot on the 24th of July. And he has been to, I believe in the film, he says he's been to 190 countries. And he sort of, he was actually shot by I think it's a Slovakian filmmaker, who happened to be filming him on this day, because he'd met him at an airport somewhere in Asia, in Ladakh, I believe, and he thought, I want to film this person. So he started filming him, because he was a would-be documentary maker. And then he got back home into Slovakia, and he realized that this Life in a Day project was happening. So he came over to London, he bought a ticket, he said, this is too much of a coincidence. He came over to London and handed me this drive, and said, this is what I filmed on the 24th of July, and it's obviously meant to be in some way that I did it on that day. And it's Ok Hwan, this character, telling you why he's been cycling around the world for so long, and he's cycling through the city of Ladakh, and he is in some ways a holy fool. That's how I look at him. He's a kind of totem for the whole movie. He is the man who, you know, who has been everywhere, who has seen everything, and in a way, in this 95 minutes of the film that you, the audience, see, that's just some of the few highlights of what someone like him, who has actually traveled around the whole world, would see. So, you know, what was taking him 10 years, you get to do in 95 minutes.
Right.
And what you realize from him is that the reason he's doing this pilgrimage, in a way, cause I think it is something religious that he's cycling around the world, going on and on and on, is because he wants to bring peace between North Korea and South Korea. But it's not in some way that he's protesting. Nobody knows that he's doing it. It's like a prayer in some way like a pilgrimage that he thinks by doing this extraordinary task, this feat, by, in a way, suffering himself physically by doing it, because he's had a lot of near misses and road accidents and illnesses and things. But by doing this, in some way, he can affect what happens in the physical world.
Right.
So he's an eccentric and fantastic character that, like a lot of the characters in the film, you would never come across otherwise. You know, these are people who I would never meet. In a million years, would you never meet these people, and you get to know them, you get a little insight into their lives.
And there are people who reveal things about themselves without knowing that they're doing so, revealing something either goofy or just stupid, like the guy who says to presumably his wife, feed the ducks and they're seagulls.
Yes.
He looks just so silly, but he's very serious about it.
He's hilarious. And there are all sorts of, there are people who sort of sent things in that I would have thought, I don't want anyone to see that.
Exactly.
There's a man and wife having an argument about, the wife has obviously just had twin babies and is exhausted, and the father is being very pompous and going on about Walt Whitman.
Exactly.
And how fantastic Walt Whitman is, and he wants his babies to know this particular quote from Walt Whitman, and wife's saying, would you just shut up? You know, I'm so tired, I've had the babies all day. The husband just won't quit and keeps going on in a very pompous way. And I would never have sent that in, but they did. And I think that's great, because it's great for me as a filmmaker anyway, and for an audience, because you really get incredible intimacies. And I think that's the thing. When people have a camera that they're controlling themselves, they will film things that they wouldn't otherwise allow anyone to film. You know, you can't send a film crew in to capture those sort of moments. That has to be, they have to come from self-filming. And I think that's one of the things about the film that's very unusual that I've realized, as the more I've seen it, is that there's a flavor to it that's very different than any other film you've seen, or certainly any documentary you've seen, because it's all filmed by amateurs, and it has this, therefore, this sense of enthusiasm and of love about it. You know, people are loving what they're doing in the true sense of the word amateur. You know, they love the thing that they're doing, and they're sending this material in out of a sense of generosity, not out of any sense of I want to be famous, I want to make money off it, because nobody was going to make money off it, but just actually out of I want to share something from my life. And that's the feeling I get off a lot of the best clips.
We're talking to Kevin MacDonald about the film Life in a Day. I was struck, and especially watching it the second time and having some time in between to think about it. I mean, the images from it stayed with me, like the giraffe giving birth and the girl doing a hula hoop while solving a Rubik's Cube at the same time, and all these little moments that are amazing. But what I ended up feeling like was that the film is like a mosaic where every little piece is a piece of its own with its own integrity, but it makes up a larger whole. But then that leaves a big question. What is the larger whole?
Well, I think the larger whole is about, or is the theme of togetherness, and I suppose of connectivity. And it sounds, the problem is, I don't like talking about this because it sounds like a real cliche, and I don't like talking in cliches, but, you know, I think the film reaffirms the truth behind the cliche that we're all the same, really, wherever we are. And I think that the film is also, not only is it about a single day on Earth, but it's also kind of gives you a snapshot of what your own life is going to be like, the permutations of your own life. And because you see all the major things that are going to happen to you and to me and to everybody on Earth, you see, you know, birth and childhood, and you see exhilaration, you see depression, you see violence, you see love, and you see illness, and you see death. And it's sort of like life brought down to its absolute basics in some way. Because that's why I think amateurs film, because I think people who are filming themselves, and it's not necessarily done in a sophisticated, artistic way, it's what's important to me, what matters. That's what I want to have a record of, what matters. And I think that's what it kind of amounts to for me, and I didn't intend it to be that. It just sort of, that's what it turned into. And I think in some ways the director of this film, I feel like in some ways somebody who was doing automatic writing, you know, like surrealists used to do, you're almost taken over by a spirit to do it. And actually, you know, we really were just following the serendipity, following what somehow the spirit of the world, the zeitgeist, wanted us to say on that day.
I did have the feeling watching it that there is this web of life, and I mean, it is hard not to talk in cliches about these kinds of things, but there's this web of life, and there's something that's much larger than we are. And as you say, everybody who is beautiful and stupid and egotistical and insecure and full of themselves and all of these things, they're all me, they're all you, they're all part of us. And one doesn't have the opportunity every day to actually experience that, because we're really stuck inside of this vantage point of our own bodies and our own lives.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that, the risk of sounding a bit pretentious, that one of the things the editor and I talked about quite a lot when we were cutting it was that in some ways you could see the film as being about one person who transmogrifies through the film, who changes bodies. It's almost as though there's one perspective. It's a human being, and he's a child, now he's an adult, now he's dying, now he's loving, now he's this, or she, I could say. And that it does almost feel like one perspective, one person's journey through a day. And that's a strange feeling. I don't know why it gives that feeling, but that, I definitely had that when we were putting it together. But I think the extraordinary thing about this for me as a filmmaker to do was that I started off thinking it was an experimental film, you know, and a film that would be shown at a few film festivals and would be, you know, of interest academically because it's, you know, using the internet to make a movie. And this, but actually, as we finished it, we realized that it's a film which is really accessible and that actually it's enjoyable and moving for pretty much anybody, I think, and that, you know, what started as an experiment ends up being actually a very easy to appreciate and sort of unexperimental film.
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody should go see it because there's, I don't know, I've never seen anything like it or been moved exactly in that way. And just in terms of craft, it's also so well done. I mean, one of the things that I noticed, especially the second time watching it, is the way you use music. So you add music, but you also use, for example, with the Angolan women who are singing and beating maize, you're using their music or you're using the sound in the footage that you got. And that's done in a way that's really skillful and seamless.
Well, one of the things we wanted to do is to have as much of the movie possible made on the 24th of July. So that meant also the soundtrack. So the composer that I employed was a guy called Matthew Herbert, who did most of the music in the film, and he actually used a lot of the sounds. That's what he does. He's an experimental composer who uses found sounds to make his music. So a lot of the sounds in the music are themselves things that were in the footage that people sent in. But we did actually ask people who were very keen to sort of get further involved in the film. You know, they'd filmed their life, they'd filmed their day. Would you want to do more? And if people said yes, then on that day we also asked them to record some sounds, record your favorite sound, record the sound of yourself breathing, the sound of a hand clap. And those sounds were then used either in the composition or in and of themselves in the film. So, for instance, there's a moment where you see this beautiful skydiving shot of somebody in Spain diving towards the earth. And as they approach the earth, you hear this cacophony of noises. That cacophony is made up of, I think, about 3,000 sounds that people sent in as their favorite sounds. So it's the sound of the earth as it approaches, and all those sounds, we just layered them on top of each other. So you have, you know, a baby's laughter, you have a steam train, you have, the sound of a doorbell, all these different things, all sort of layered up. And at the beginning of the film, you have, the first thing you hear is the sound of 1,000 people breathing. So you get, and that's from all the people who sent in the breath, their breath. And elsewhere, for instance, there's a very shocking scene, I suppose, for some people, of a cow being killed in the film. And this cow is in a slaughterhouse, and it knows it's going to die, and it bangs against the side of its cage. And that sound Matthew then used as the rhythm element in a kind of darker version of dark part of the film towards the end, which is about, I guess, the destructive side of life. And you hear this as the rhythm track, and that's the sound of the cow. So there's all sorts of things about where you layer in the actual found sounds into the music.
Did you end up using something from every country that you got footage from?
No, I didn't. I think there's about 60 countries represented in the film. That was a real sort of struggle in a way. But a kind of question in my mind was, how representative do you have to be? And in the end, I felt, that wasn't really my job. I wasn't making an academic treatise. I was trying to make a film that, interested me, that was moving, that sort of hopefully said something. And in order to do that, I wanted to use the best material. And I didn't want to be bound by, there's a big sort of issue with the film in some ways, which is that, or the process of making it, that although we advertised everywhere in the world, we still had 50% of the material came from Canada and the USA. And so that meant that by the law of averages, you're going to have more good stuff from those countries.
Right.
And so Russia and Ukraine are also way overrepresented because there was more stuff from there than from other places. But then sometimes you got, from Cameroon, I think we had two clips, and one of them is this amazing clip of pygmies going out hunting for the day in the jungle, and it's really extraordinary and filmed by one of the people who we sent cameras out to. And there's an incredible thing to that. It's not countries needed to send in a lot to be represented. It's just that the law of averages tells you that the more that comes from a particular country, the more that's going to be good. And also, I think, let's face it, in the Western world, maybe particularly in America, people are very good at understanding filming and understanding filming themselves and feel they have things to say. Often I felt when, we sent cameras out to, say, a remote village in northern India, and people would take it up and they'd talk about things, but they do it in a very stilted kind of way, almost as though they felt they were being interviewed by, an official news program or something.
Right.
And I think I started to realize that, obviously, people like that had never seen a documentary before. They had no idea what we were going to use this footage for. They had no idea, they probably had only seen state television and a few Bollywood movies. And that whole idea of expressing your own opinion about things and people being interested in your own opinion, I think probably was quite alien to them. That's a very Western way of operating, I think.
Is the film available to? Have you kept track of the people who contributed to it? Did they get to see it?
Yeah, well, there was a kind of prize element to the film when we made it, which was that anyone who got the films that I considered to be the 20 most interesting, those people got invited to come to Sundance to the festival. So I met 20, in fact, I think about 23 of the filmmakers who came from all over the world. A little Japanese boy and his father from Tokyo. I met the shoeshine boy from Peru. I met the woman from Bali who filmed her maid and her house, and Egyptian filmmakers. And so many people came to Sundance, and that was an amazing experience as well. These people who have nothing in common at all suddenly together and unified by having made this film together. So I've got to know them, and then I've publicized the film here in the UK and in Berlin when we showed at the Berlin Film Festival. We've met the local filmmakers. If anyone contributed, we've tried to invite them along to the premieres in those countries or to festival screenings. We've tried to make it continue to be a kind of community experience, or not just a kind of commercial experience.
Kevin MacDonald is the director of the film Life in a Day, which is at the CCA here in Santa Fe. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much for talking to me. That was very interesting.
Mm-hmm. deceive.
And we've been listening to a track from Mari Sato's new disc, Return to the River. Mari Sato is a singer-songwriter, and her release party for the new CD is this Friday, the 26th of August, at 6 o'clock at the Center for Spiritual Living. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. I'm happy to be here today and so excited to release this new CD that has been many, many years in the making, and we are finally here.
As we heard in the piece of the song that we just were playing, you definitely have a lot of Japanese influence in your music. You are half Japanese, but as I understand it, the actual musical Japanese part of your musical life is fairly recent.
Yes, it's been almost 8 years now on the path of studying traditional Japanese music in Japan, as well as with a wonderful elder teacher named Michiko Pierce, who actually lives in Albuquerque. So I have been on this path, I mean, dived into it deeply, and kind of left the career path I had for a while of doing jazz, blues, R&B style music, and just focused on learning the tradition and working with all traditional artists from Japan.
So that's quite a musical thing to take on. I mean, you're taking on pentatonic scales, rhythms, vocal techniques, and themes.
That's right. It's just expanded my world beyond my dreams to be able to learn this tradition. It's in my blood. My family is all from Sendai, Japan, and the first lesson I ever had in Sendai was with a teacher who lived behind my aunt's house, Hiroko Sensei. She taught me this folk song, and I came home, and within an hour, it's like a 5-minute piece, I had it memorized. It just felt so good in my body, in my mouth. And so
Hearing any of this?
I didn't. But when I first heard some of the traditional music on a trip that I took there in a concert, tears began to pour from my eyes because I felt like it was like the blues and the gospel of the South, which was a big influence of my life musically. And I related it to that, and I said, it's got so much passion and emotion in it. And if I had grown up in Japan, my father's homeland of Sendai, I would probably sing this kind of music.
So you've been studying with teachers here in New Mexico. You also have gone to Japan.
Yes, several times, although it was late in life, well, in my late 20s that I returned to Japan. And reunited with my grandmother and aunts and uncles. And it had been a dream of mine to return to Japan, but when I was 5 years old, we moved to Japan. And within a year, my father passed away, who is my link to Japan, and my mother's Irish Cherokee background, and so we came back to America, and my mother never wanted to go back because it was such a traumatic experience to have her husband die and left with three little babies. So it was something far away, distant, you know, dream of mine, and then an opportunity opened for me to go there, and I kind of stopped my whole path that was leading me to Los Angeles with a new album and a tour, and I decided to go to Japan. And I could never go back to the old life. It was like a new beginning, a new awakening going there.
It was that way both musically and in other ways as well?
Very much so. When you step onto homeland and you see the sea of faces and even dark hair that looks like you, something settled in my bones, and I looked at my grandmother's face and I said, I have the same mark on my face, I have the same shape of face, and it's like a confidence, inner confidence begins to blossom. And that's what happened, and I found myself really drawn to the spirituality of Japan and began to learn more about my culture, my heritage.
Mari Sato, the new album is called, the new disc is called Return to the River. What's that's a name of one of the songs that we'll maybe hear, if we're lucky, a little bit of in a moment. But where's the title come from?
It's a song that refers to me going back to my five-year-old self in Sendai, Japan, at Tanabata Festival. It's a large festival, very celebrated in Sendai, a children's festival where people go to the river and they put their little paper boats in the river with candles and prayers. And if the night is clear, the gods will answer your prayers. Well, that festival is very meaningful to me because I attended it with my father, and the next week he passed away. And I've always had this kind of spiritual, emotional connection to that time of year in Sendai. And so this song, Return to the River, has lyrics which I composed that speak of this mythology of these star lovers and this festival. But it also refers to me returning to my home, to my father's land, and reconnecting with my relatives and my heritage.
Now, your little daughter is 5 right now, and she sings on this disc with you.
Yes. Oh, it's magical the way that the synchronistic events are occurring with this project. I mean, it's been flowing like a river. It's had a lot of support and a lot of movement, but things like my daughter being able to sing with me on this song at the same age of 5 where I lost my daughter, it's been a very healing experience to have a daughter be 5, and she has her mom and she's got a dad, and it's a beautiful thing.
The proceeds from the disc are partly going to go to relief efforts in Japan.
That's right. I will be donating a portion of the proceeds of the sale of this album to an organization called CASA, which stands for Kindness America Sendai Alliance. And this is a nonprofit organization that is focusing their efforts on helping the smaller villages of Sendai that are maybe getting overlooked by the large epicenter and with the large organizations coming in working mainly there, and also to have meaningful interactions of kindness between Japanese and Americans.
Is that something that you've been involved in directly yourself?
Yes, I am part of the board of this new nonprofit organization, and my brother Stephen Sato is the one who started it, and he has quit his job to follow the path to make this organization thrive, and it's really doing well. And you can learn more about CASA by going to casacommunity.org.
And that's CASA with a K, K-A-S-A, community.org. And you can find out more about Madi Sato by going to Madi, M-A-D-I, Sato, S-A-T-O, madisato.com. The release party for the new CD, Return to the River, is this Friday, the 26th of August, at 6 in the evening at the Center for Spiritual Living. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
And we're going to go out with a little bit of the track, Return to the River. I'm delighted now to welcome to the program John Kloss and Bert Dalton. John is a tap dancer, Bert Dalton, keyboard player, and we are talking about the second annual Santa Fe Tap Festival this Friday and Saturday, the 26th and 27th of August, performance at the Lensic on Friday night, and workshop classes all day Saturday. Welcome, gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Great to have you back, Bert, and great to have you for the first time, John Kloss. So let's talk about tap dancing for a moment. There is a long history, about 150 or more years old, of this dance form.
That's correct.
Tell us more about it.
Well, it was born in America some time back and is owes its origins primarily to two main cultural influences, the rhythm dances of Africa and Northern European step dancing.
Particularly Irish?
Mostly Irish, although there's a variety of step dancing traditions in England and on the continent in Northern Europe as well.
One of the things that's so interesting about the way dance and culture evolved in the African diaspora is how different cultural forms were used to hide ritual activity.
Exactly, and to communicate to nearby locations via rhythm certain things that were going on. For example, in the colonies, if a group of slaves on a plantation wanted to communicate a message to a neighboring plantation, they would often choose rhythm to do so.
And so this evolved as a way of communicating. It evolved as a form of dance. What was the nature of that, what would you call it, merging of European step dancing and African dancing? In other words, how did those groups meet each other and teach each other their things?
Well, they would see each other doing their things, and there was a certain amount of grabbing from the other tradition and incorporating it into one's own tradition and kind of elaborating on it and expounding on it and, I guess, topping it, if you will, or trying to dress it up and make it better.
Almost in a competitive way?
Almost in a competitive way, or sometimes we call it clowning it, like taking it and kind of making fun of it a little bit, but then, you know, making it better and more impressive. And, you know, it's part of, I guess, the melting pot culture of America to grab those various influences, bring them into the form and kind of remix them in new ways.
And then there were minstrel shows and all sorts of shows that used tap.
Yes, that's correct. There was, it started with minstrel shows and then kind of evolved into touring presentations as part of the vaudeville circuit, and then kind of evolved into the movie musicals, like many people are familiar with. And then there was a bit of a lull, like in the 50s, 60s mostly actually, when television became more prominent. And around the 70s, there was a bit of a resurgence and a rekindled interest, largely due to the work of a famous tap dancer named Gregory Hines, who brought it kind of more into contemporary culture and started taking more contemporary influences that he found in the music.
Now, there's a beautiful thing about tap, which is it's really both. I mean, when you are tapping as a dancer, you're both a dancer and a musician.
Exactly. So there's this visual component and the sound component as well.
It draws very much on jazz. I mean, syncopated rhythms are what tap is all about. You're not just doing 1, 2, 3, 4.
Right. Since tap grew up kind of hand-in-hand with jazz music, or kind of evolved during the jazz age, we all kind of have that as our foundation as tap dancers. We identify, I think, mostly in the jazz tradition. But tap is very much kind of a conceptual percussion art form where we can dance not only to jazz music but anything really that has a steady pulse, and sometimes no music at all. So it's really about the rhythm, whether it's jazz music or hip-hop music or classical even.
How did you get into it?
How did I get into it? When I was about 5 years old, my mother took me to the doctor because I was pigeon-toed. My feet were poorly aligned, and asked the doctor what they could do for me, and the doctor recommended tap dance classes. So I went to my neighborhood dance studio and started tap dancing there.
So you started as a small child, the way some people start ballet at that age, many people.
Yeah, but I only lasted a couple of years because I was a little boy and I wanted to be running around in the neighborhood messing around with my friends. So I left it for a good 10, 15 years and then came back to it much later.
And did you come back to it just for fun, randomly? Or
It was a little bit of that. And I had gotten a flyer or something for a tap festival that was happening in Chicago at the time. And there I became introduced to this subculture of tap dance artists and enthusiasts who really expanded my understanding and appreciation of the art form. And I saw that it was a lot more than I had thought it was. People kind of tend to think of tap as this throwback art form, when in reality it's very much, when it grew up with jazz music, it grew up with the music of the time. And it's continuing to grow and evolve with the music of the time now.
What are some of the evolutions of tap that we may not know about?
Well, there's, hip-hop music is very popular with tap dancers. So there's a lot of cross-genre collaborations with hip-hop artists, beatboxers, turntablists, DJs. We really like to grab whatever we can that we think is interesting and kind of play with it.
Did it cure your pigeon toes?
I think it did, actually.
Now, Bert Dalton, you are playing as part of the festivities this weekend, the second annual Santa Fe Tap Festival.
Indeed. I was so fortunate that John asked me to participate last year, and quite frankly, I didn't know what I was getting myself into. There wasn't a lot of music coming our way before the concert. A lot of it was put together in the rehearsals, but he brings this amazing troupe of dancers and musicians from the Bay Area, and it was really easy just to slide in with those guys. They made me sound good, and it was just really a lot of fun. There's a lot of improvisation. What John said, there's really a mix of genres. You know, there's funk, there's hip-hop, there's jazz. I think we even did some Latin last year. And
Latin tap.
Yeah. It's amazing. I mean, it's a lot more than just, tap dancing to Fats Waller or T for Two. I mean, he's really taken it a new direction. We're really lucky to have John here in Santa Fe. You know, he does a lot of teaching. I think the workshop on Saturday is going to be terrific. He's kind of the keeper of the flame here.
Is there a tap dancing scene in Santa Fe, or is it something that you're just developing?
There are a lot of tap dance enthusiasts already in Santa Fe, and there's a lot of students, especially at NDI, where Bert is music director. And it's slowly kind of, I think, snowballing, if you will, or growing a little bit, and hopefully that keeps happening.
Do you teach? I mean, you're doing a teaching workshop this weekend, but are you teaching classes on a regular basis?
Yes. As part of NDI's program, I teach kids' classes and actually one adult continuing beginner sort of class. So maybe if you might be interested in trying some tap dancing one time, you can drop on by.
Or our listeners, yes. No, because, I mean, when I see tap dancing, and of course there's so much that you do with your upper body, but one really thinks about the feet. So how much emphasis is there on what you're doing with your arms and shoulders and so on?
Well, there's different schools of thought, and there's different styles within tap. There's a spectrum of styles that, goes from the primary, almost complete focus is on just the rhythm, and then there's the more presentational, visual sort of aspect like you might see in most Broadway shows.
Why don't we get out the piano and put on your tap shoes, and can you do a little bit of performance here in the Baking Company?
Let me roll this grand piano over here, me and Mary Charlotte.
And I'll just roll over this tap floor. That's
amazing that it just happened to be here.
Look at that. It's just so easy. What are you going to play?
Don't Mean a Thing If It Ain't Got That Swing.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Cafe burst into applause. Bert Dalton on keyboards and John Kloss in honor of the second annual Santa Fe Tap Festival. Ladies and gentlemen, we will see you tomorrow night at the Lenzic, Friday the 26th of August at 7:30, and workshop classes at National Dance Institute Dance Barns, Saturday all day from 10 in the morning until 5 in the afternoon. For more information, stepology.com. You make it look so easy.
I'd like to respond to that, but I need to catch my breath first. it's fun, and when you have somebody like Bert there playing with you, I mean, that makes it even more fun. So it's easy that way.
For me, it's like working with a really good drummer. It really makes it exciting.
And it is working with a really good drummer.
It is, yeah. And I never know what he's going to do either. It's very improvisational. It's really fun.
Well, thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thank you.
And before we go this morning, I want to remind people about the very special evening with Russ Baker, award-winning investigative journalist, author of the book Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years. He's editor of the news website whowhatwhy.com, and he will be in Santa Fe doing a benefit for KSFR this Saturday, the 27th of August, at 7 in the evening at the Armory for the Arts. For information and reservations, please call 428-1379. Yours truly will be moderating the question and answer and introducing Russ Baker. It should be a great night. Hope to see you there. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.